Já, góðan daginn. Kristján Gíslason heiti ég og ég býði ykkur velkomin í þennan spjallþátt með Andy Duke. So in English, welcome. This is Kristján Gíslason from Iceland. I welcome you to the podcast with Andy Dukes.
Greetings all. It's our first Icelandic guest on Ride and Talk. He doesn't identify as a motorcyclist, but after one round-the-world trip and various other journeys into Africa, Russia and beyond, I beg to differ. But why not make your own mind up for this engaging podcast with an inspiring philanthropist? Christian, lovely to have you here as a guest. Welcome to Ride and Talk.
Thank you. Thank you.
Christian, I have to confess, reading your book and watching your documentary series has made me want to travel again. I thought I got it out of my system, but no, you've given me that feeling of wanting to hit the road again, so thank you for that.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad that I had that influence on you by making the book. And but the purpose of my book was to actually to recap my experience, and which was enormous, as you know, you yourself, having been around the world. It was actually a privilege for me to be able to write the book, because you have to get this experience out of your system, as you said, but to have it in front of you, you can always, you know, review and remind you of what you have been through. So that's a good thing to have.
Absolutely. So many parallels, as I've said to you, but also so many differences as well. And that's one of the things that was really interesting for me, because we took a very similar route on the initial stage of our respective round-the-world journeys from Europe to Southeast Asia. But one big difference I noticed back then was that I really defined myself as a motorcyclist right from the beginning, whereas you didn't. You saw yourself more as a traveler on a motorcycle.
Yes, I must admit, you know, I haven't been into this motorcycling for a long time. I started on the motorcycle when I was 56 years old. And a year later, I decided to go around the world on a motorcycle, alone. And this was probably not a wise thing to do, you know, because I didn't have the experience. And a lot of people were both amazed and more than that, they were very surprised, you know, to learn that I was going to go alone around the world.
But what were your motivations in the first place for doing the trip?
You see, I was a keen golfer, and I was playing golf, and I only dreamt about golf. And I was down to, 9.6 in handicap when I had to stop because of back pains. And I didn't have any other sport to go into, because my life was just golf. And then a friend of mine, he said, why don't you come with us, you know, a couple guys here for a ride, and I will lend you the motorcycle. And we rode over the weekend about 1,700 kilometers. And then at that time, I just felt the freedom and the excitement of riding the motorcycle in the countryside. And I also saw the possibilities of combining the motorcycle sport with my passion for photography. So that was the beginning of my, you know, my motorcycle experience. Then, you know, a year later, when I decided to go around the world, I invited this friend of mine who had invited me for a weekend ride. I invited him around the world with me. We were going to go together, but he bailed out at the last minute. And I said, you know, he read too much on the internet. He got afraid. And at a certain time, I had to stop when I was preparing my trip. I had to stop reading all the stories on the internet, because they made me afraid. And then I had to decide, you know, shall I go alone or just skip this? And then my father, at the age of 89, he said, Christian, just go alone. This would be much bigger experience for you to go alone. You will have all kinds of openings. People will come up to you and so on and so. So he was the biggest supporter for me to go alone.
Wise words indeed from your father.
Yeah. And he said, never stop daring. That's the last sentence in my book. Never stop daring. Never stop to dare. And that is so true. You know, you can always talk yourself out of situations. No, it's not, I shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do this. It's too much of a risk, too much of trouble and so on. No, do it. Do it. Because such experiences will enrich your life so much.
Totally agree. You know? Totally agree. And, you know, the hardest part in any of these things is actually making the decision to go in the first place. And it was very wise of your father to encourage you to go alone, because as you've since found out, it was absolutely the best decision that you could have made. What I found amazing from looking at your documentaries was, well, compared to me, at least, you, even though you had no knowledge of motorcycles and you were inexperienced, as you say, you couldn't change a tire, you really did get yourself organized. You know, you had a dealer set up a technical preparation course for you. You organized a personal trainer. You learned first aid. You did rider training. You practiced self-defense. You did so much route planning. It really was a systematic approach to doing this trip, wasn't it?
To start with, I'm a systems analyst, so I like to have things in order, you know, to start there. But the thing is that I was waking up in the middle of the night sweating, and I had a piece of paper and a pencil on the desk, and I wrote down what I was thinking about when I woke up. And in the morning, then I looked at it and said, okay, I'm afraid of this. What will I do if I will have a puncture? I don't know. I have to learn it, you know. So that, in that way, I made my memo list during the nights, you know. So I had to work on these things to get my mind settled, you know, to be in control.
It just makes me realize how ill-prepared I was. I literally threw a few things in the panniers and sort of head off. And I also noticed from those preparations that you took a lot more gear than I did. I mean, you even had a spare tire on the back of the top box. And you must have had a lot of weight on that bike when you left. But again, these are things that you just don't know until you know, do you?
No, you don't know them until you have to use them. Then you face another problem: is to find all the things you stored on the bike. So you had to also organize that. But to be honest, I took too much with me, and on the way I threw out things and I added other things, and I think I had to renewed more or less everything when I came back. More or less, you know.
Yeah, I always make a joke with my daughter. She goes away for the weekend somewhere in the UK and puts more into the back of her car than I did to travel around the world for a year. But it's something we all learn, isn't it? So you actually started the trip with a couple of friends who were actually riding with you for the whole European leg of the trip. I think they rode with you until Istanbul and then they returned home. And I remember you looking almost in a state of shock at that moment at the enormity of what lay ahead of you, crossing that gateway into Asia and basically heading into the unknown. That was an incredible feeling of emotion that I sensed from seeing that particular video.
Yeah, I think my trip started there, actually. I had been preparing for 8 months. I said goodbye to my family, my father, my wife, and so. But I didn't take it in that I was going to be alone, because they followed me through Europe to Istanbul, as you said. And then when I said goodbye to them, then I felt the real trip was starting. And it was a shock for me to also being in a completely new, not only environment, but also in another culture. You know, you could hear all the all the noises from the mosques and so on. So it was all weird for me, you know. So it was a really big moment for me, shall I say.
Yeah, it was a very, very honest bit of filmmaking. I could see your fear, and I remember feeling that fear myself. So it really struck a chord with me. But what was really interesting also was that there was this slow realization after then that people were interested in you, that they wanted to help you, that there was this realization that allowed you to start adapting to your new circumstances, to start trusting others and to just go with the flow whenever possible.
There was no country on the way that I was as much afraid of as going into Iran. Somehow, it was a big moment for me to go into Iran. I was so much afraid. I don't know why, you know. But as soon as I got to know these people, I asked myself, actually, from what planet are these people? I had never experienced as much generosity, helpfulness. They are just lovely, all the people in Iran. And I tell you, I had visa for 14 days. I was invited to their homes, out for dinner, or people paid for my dinner 10 times. Unfortunately, I couldn't accept all the invitations. But, you know, this is just to show how lovely these people were. And I think from that moment, I realized that my preconceptions were not right. You know, I was prejudiced, we can say, not only towards people, but culture and the way of living and all that. When I, on the other hand, started to learn, when I started to get to know the people and their culture and appreciate, then I started to take it all in and learn something. And I think that is one of the reasons why I always extended my trip, because I found this was not only in Iran. I mean, Iran is a certain exception, but this was everywhere. Everywhere I went, people were so friendly. And I often say, you know, 99% of the people I met were not only nice people, they were fantastic.
Yeah, I had the same positive experiences in Iran. And I think it's you don't need to feel guilty about feeling as if you were prejudiced, because in a way we have the Western media to, that's the only way we can get our information. And of course there's propaganda that goes both ways, and of course there's bias. So it was just fantastic that you're able to experience that, and then that you're able to share it with the world as well. And of course I was following your blog at the time, and there were so many moving stories, evocative videos, and amazing portraits that you took on this 50,000 kilometer trip over the 10 months that you said. So suffice to say that we'd need several podcasts to cover all the details.
Yeah.
But fortunately, you've published a fantastic book about this trip that we will talk about later. But for now, I'm interested to know that outside of Iran, where you felt in danger, but obviously it didn't materialize, were there any other places where you felt in danger on your travels?
As you said, I wrote close to 48,000 kilometers. I can say that out of those 48,000 kilometers, I was on a critical path, 800 kilometers of that. I was in a convoy with either police or the military, but I never felt threatened. But the places where I was in a convoy was in East India, right before we came into Myanmar, in the mountains there. It was in Colombia, and it was the last 300 kilometers in Mexico before I entered Texas. There, in Mexico, I felt something. And it is a place where the drug producers and the military are fighting. They are not actually going for the tourists or motorcyclists, but they are fighting, you know, the drug war is still going on there. I was being followed by a car in East India at the night, and I usually never ride my motorcycle when it's getting dark, as you know, it's dangerous. But this time I made an exception, and a car followed me, and then I decided to stop and see, because I was going too fast, you know. The guy who was riding the car, the driver, he stopped and said to me, "You are entering a dangerous zone. You can either, you know, come with me back, you can stay with me, or I can find a place for you." And I had to, at that time, I had to judge, you know, is he a crook, you know, can I trust him? I decided to trust him. So I went back and I stayed with him in his house. Fantastic. It was amazing. Yeah.
That is amazing, because two things really. One, you had to make a judgment call. You effectively put your life in the hands of a stranger at that moment. Two, he went out of his way to help a complete stranger who he realized was, he probably read your number plate, or he obviously had motorcycles in that part of the world of that size. It was clear you were a traveler and you were maybe not on the road you should have been on, but he went out of his way to flag you down and to warn you. Not only that, he gave you shelter. That's incredible.
Yeah, yeah. And told me all the story about this and what was happening and so on, you know. I skipped a checkpoint. That was my mistake. I thought, you know, this was just a formality, but it was a checkpoint to safeguard me.
We've all done it. We've all done it.
Yeah.
What about actual riding conditions? What were the toughest riding conditions you encountered? Which country would you say?
It was probably in Myanmar. We went through Myanmar. We were 10 of us. We met on the internet and we shared the cost of going through Myanmar. It costed about $22,000 for us, 10 of us. And we were in a convoy with a guide on a big four-wheel drive. And he, you know, he wanted to show us a good, you know, the mountain side of the Myanmar, which are incredible, and the life there, you know, he took us back a couple hundred years back, you know, in time, and we experienced the countryside, which was great, but at the same time, the conditions there were not good, and it was muddy roads, and it had been raining, and so on, so people were falling. And it was the toughest one.
You probably had road tires on as well, did you?
Yeah, I didn't have good tires for that. You know, you could see that actually in the documentary. I was just spinning the wheels, you know. But fortunately, I got unhurt there. Also, going up some of the mountains in India, where the gravel roads, and it had been raining and the conditions were really bad. The trucks were either, you know, broken or whatever, and I was there on my motorcycle with all my gear, about 95 kilos of everything, you know, and I knew that I couldn't fall, you know, because first of all, it was just difficult for me to race the motorcycle. I had to unload everything and then pick up the bike and load everything back. And that costs energy, you know. Not talking about getting injured, but, you know, I'm just talking about...
It's exhausting. It's absolutely exhausting, yeah.
You know, exhausting. You know, hot, humid and all this, you know. So I had to... And I'm alone, like you were. I'm alone. And in some cases and some roads, there were not a lot of people, you know. You had to rely on yourself. And that was tough for me, especially because I didn't have that experience, you know.
And you were on the 800 GS. Did you have any technical problems at all?
No, I didn't. I decided to go on the 800 or on a BMW because I wanted to a reliable motorcycle. Some people said you should go on a Honda or Yamaha or whatever because it can be fixed on the way. But I decided to rely on the German engineering, and they didn't put me down. I mean, it was really. I must say, I'm not sponsored by BMW. I've never been. So, but I it was. But having said that, I shouldn't have been on the 800. 800 is too aggressive for a man like me with such a little experience. The 1200 is the perfect bike for me.
Yeah, the power delivery is completely different. I mean, I absolutely love the 800. It just kind of suited me. But then I love the 1200 as well. But you mentioned at the start of our chat today that you didn't know how to fix a puncture when you started thinking about your trip. Did you get any on your trip?
Twice. One was in Myanmar, and then I had the assistance of my partners, the 10 travelers. You know, they were much better. They had more experience. Some of them had more experience than I did. But then my second one was in the middle of the Nullarbor desert in Australia, and that was quite challenge for me.
Yeah, you've got to be resourceful on the Nullarbor plain, that's for sure. It's interesting what you said about, the group of travellers who assisted you, because it is also a remarkably small world out there on the road, isn't it? I mean, I saw you stayed with my friend Hussein in Iran. He got me across the border. I think you met my friend Tin in Myanmar, and you rode some of your trip, and I think it was that bit you were just mentioning with Rolf Langer. He's also been a guest on this podcast, so all these people, they're part of your journey, and you never forget them, do you, ever?
Never. That was. They had actually been together more. They went through Russia, and so we met together in India just before we went into Myanmar. But they had been riding together for at least 1 or 2 weeks, so they got to know each other much better. But I made friendship with them as well, and some of them have come to Iceland after that.
Super, super. And I think Rolf might be on the road again, so lovely guy. I'm interested to know, because it's certainly something that happened to me, and I felt guilty about it at the time. Did you ever get homesick?
To be honest, I don't think so. Don't recall. But I missed my grandchildren.
We'll cut out this part from your wife then.
It's good. No, she knows me well enough to, but I missed my grandchild. At that time, I had one grandchild, and I had a guilty feeling leaving my
Yeah,
grandchild.
because you miss so much when
But
they're young and they change so quickly, don't they?
no, that was really the thing. But what I did to overcome that, and I made a small project. I made a T-shirt with a picture of my only grandchild here on the front, and then I took pictures, of me wearing the T-shirt in front of famous buildings, Taj Mahal and other, the Opera House in Sydney, and the Liberty Statue in New York, and many, many, many other places. So when I came back, I composed a small video to give him, So that will be his present for this trip, And now I'm composing another, and now I'm co composing a book for him or for my grandchildren with the same concept. So I try to do something about this, guiltiness of mine.
Yeah, well, that's a great way of dealing with it. What about people on the road? Are there any people who left a particularly strong impression on you? I mean, I can see behind you there's that portrait of an Indian woman with very sad eyes. What's the story there?
Well, that is, I'll tell you one thing here. One of the things that have changed inside of me is that I am so emotional after this trip. I think it's, you know, I'm so thankful and humble of being able to do this, but, you know, but it's more than that. It's just the humbleness for the life I was given, you know. It turns out that this travel has become some kind of a privilege and a pilgrimage journey. And I am so appreciative and humble. And you asked me for, you know, the story behind this picture. I start almost crying thinking of it, you know. But it was I was in a small restaurant. It was just a road restaurant, very primitive road restaurant. And this girl was working there, just cleaning up and so on. And she was so unhappy. But still in this environment with her beautiful scarf and how she was dressed with a colorful dress on and with the bricks in the back and the light coming to her, I wanted to get a portrait of her. And I knew, you know, I couldn't approach her. I went to the owner and said, can I have a picture of you with this girl? And I did that. I took a picture. And then I asked the owner, can you step back here? I just want to have the picture of her. So I managed to get the picture. And then there was some connection between me and her. And I felt, you know, what she was saying, you know, you know, thank you for recognizing me. You know, thank you. And she gave me a smile I will never forget. And I went to the bike. And when I was leaving, there were maybe 20, 30. You will see that in the documentary. You were 20, 30 people just watching me leaving. And then I was waving her and waved. And she gave me the best smile when she waved. I will never, ever forget. This was the moment. And this is actually one of the moments of my trip, small moment, but it was so powerful. So, you know, this was just a moment of respect. And I have experienced that since then also with other people.
I've seen a lot of your videos. I mean, there was that English guy. It might have even been in the Myanmar section. But I think his name was Dan or Dan Skeets or something like that.
And Dan Skeets, yeah.
And he said something like, because he was on his own personal journey, like anyone who does these big journeys. And he said something that stuck with me. It's something like, you know, you are the result of your experiences. And so, that makes perfect sense when you're sort of trying to discuss how a trip can change you, doesn't it?
Yes, it definitely. I mean, I was never expecting, to be honest with you. I mean, I was thinking of photography. That was my main mission. But coming back and realizing what kind of impact this had on myself personally, I was never expecting that. And you know, and as a result, I think, you know, I at least I hope I am a better person. I hope so, but I feel I'm different, completely different person.
Yeah, I think when you look back on a trip like that as an older man, you know, there's a lot of reflection that goes on,
yeah.
And for sure, it definitely has changed you. But what would you say was the biggest lesson that you've learned?
That's a tough question. Of course, I have I can say a few things. I think the world is much more beautiful than I expected, even though I have seen documentaries, photo books, and so on. To start with, the biggest conclusion is people are good. I mean, that's a simple way of saying we are living in a beautiful world. And because we are only two of us here talking, you know, I'm going to release a small secret here. When I got back, I found out that I was feeling so well. I mentally, physically, I was in such a good balance, and I was enjoying things much more. I think I saw the brightness of the colors more than I did before. I could spot the beauty in everything and so on. And I noticed that I had not been on, I had not been neither watching TV nor listening to radio news. And I asked myself, can this be the reason why I always extended my trip, besides working on my preconceptions and prejudices, but also I am totally isolated from the media. So I said to myself, I'm going to extend this when I come back home and see if I can stay out of the media flow. And so I said, maybe a couple weeks, maybe a couple months. But I tell you, I have never, ever, not for 1 minute, listened to radio news or TV news for 7 years. I completely skipped it. And I said, this is just a buzz. I'm not going to have it to interfere or to ruin the quality of life I have. I am getting old, you know, and I'm just going to think about quality, not only what I am eating and exercising, but also protecting this little box we call a brain, to not to absorb anything. And I think, to be honest with you, I think I have never felt as good as now.
Enviable advice that all of us could follow, but obviously life gets in the way, doesn't it? But life is busy, and of course, since coming back from that trip, you've been really busy. I mean, you also did a coast-to-coast ride across the USA after, I think, feeling that you'd maybe not ride again after the world trip. You did a ride from Iceland to Russia in 2018. You did a trip to Africa. But you've also published a book, two books, in fact. You're lecturing about your travels, and you've also started a charity foundation. So tell me about the books. Tell me about the foundation.
Yes, thank you for mentioning that. I mean, to start with, I am that fortunate. I sold my company in 2006, and I am that fortunate to be financially independent. And I can do things. I don't have to rely on anyone. I don't need any sponsors and so on, so which gives me enormous freedom of doing what I want to do. When I got back with my with all my stuff, you know, with my photos, videos, and not the least my diaries. I wrote over 500 pages of diaries around the world. So I wanted to do something about this, and I had a professional writer to help me to compose this, and a designer to make a nice look of my book, which I was only going to give to my relatives and kids and, you know, my legacy, you know. And then somebody said, you know, Christian, you should sell this. This has a value, and you should sell it. But I never could imagine myself earning money on the generosity of people allowing me to take these pictures. So then my wife and I, we decided to establish this charity fund, and we published the book, and we finance everything, the printing, the editing, and everything. So every single cent that comes in from selling the book goes into the charity fund. We take the cost. I only thought that I was going to print once the book. Now it's the third printing going on. And then the documentary, the same applies with the documentary. I made the documentary, three episodes for the around the world, and it was shown on the national TV in Iceland, which is a big honor for me. And all income from that goes to the charity fund as well. So we are working for a charity fund on volunteer basis, and we are giving money to projects that prevent young Icelanders going into drugs. This is my privilege, you know, not only to drive my motorcycle around the world and take pictures, but to work on it, to produce something, sell it, and have a good purpose doing it.
That's great. So the books are called Sliding Through and Faces of Africa. So does the Faces of Africa book support charitable work in Africa?
Yes. To start with, I want to say the Sliding Through is Sliding Through book, which can be found on slidingthrough.com, is both available in Icelandic and English. But the Faces of Africa, called Andlit Afrika, in Icelandic, Andlit Afriku, is only available in Icelandic at the moment. But the revenue that we generate from selling the Faces of Africa, plus the revenue from the documentaries that is being produced now, we expect 5 episodes, all will go into the fund, but we will now support or donate the money to education of African children.
That's brilliant. So I've been lucky to have a sneak preview of a few of your television documentaries, which, as you said, they've aired on national TV in Iceland. So are there plans for distributing these elsewhere or making them available via the usual well-known streaming platforms?
Well, we, you know, the national TV station here in Iceland is responsible for introducing this to content providers. And they said, you know, when we will have 8 to 10 episodes, like one series, then we will introduce it. So I expect that they will start introducing it after we have finished the Africa episodes.
That's incredible. So that's work in progress at the moment. That's brilliant. So I'm sure whatever you've got in the planning for those, Christian, you'll make it work, because as I've discovered, you're a very, very determined guy. So just finally, though, I know you established at the beginning of the podcast that you didn't see yourself as a motorcyclist, but a traveler on a motorcycle. But in one of those documentaries, your wife was discussing her views and her experiences, and she stated that motorcycles really connect people. And that's so true, isn't it? Because through your motorcycle, you've managed to connect people and experiences across the globe in a truly life-changing way. So if it's okay with you, I'd like to call you a motorcyclist.
Yeah, thank you. I'm honored, Andy, you do it. I should do it after I have been riding all these distances. Of course, I am a motorcyclist.
In case it got lost in the detail, Christian, just where can people find out more about the Sliding Through Foundation, and where can they buy the book and both books, in fact?
My homepage is slidingthrough.com. People can buy both books there. Having said that, Sliding Through is only available in English. People can donate also if they want to. People can also buy viewing permission to my documentaries. But I can tell you one thing, Andy. You have shown me a big respect by inviting me to your podcast. I will give everyone who is interested to see the documentary. They only have to contact me through slidingthrough.com. And mention your name, and I will send them the link free of charge, so they can see it.
Ah, wow. That's very, very kind of you. Well, listen, Christian, thanks for being our guest and entertaining us with your stories today. So I've enjoyed it immensely. Bye for now.
Thank you, Andy. Thank you.
Cheers, Christian. Like I said earlier, you've made me want to travel again. Thanks for your stories, the very best of luck with completing the documentaries, and continued success with your charitable foundation. Until next time, stay safe and take care out there, everybody.